My name is Richard Lamparsky, and as I promised you a couple of months ago when Al Hodge was on this program as Captain Video, he'd come back and be the Green Hornet. So thanks very much.
That was my pleasure.
You feel more like the Green Hornet today?
I am not really sure what I feel like today. Probably a little of both.
You were the first, right?
The first Green Hornet, that's correct.
Which began in 1936?
1936.
And you were on until how long?
Until 1951 when I went in the service. And then I think the program itself went on until around 1951 or 52 after that. I did go back, though, after I was a charge in the service. And did it for about 5 or 6 months before I came to New York.
You did the title role again?
Yes, I did.
Was it always done from Detroit?
Yes, always.
Right to the end?
Right to the very end.
Yeah, I remember it very well on WXYZ, which would be the Blue Network or ABC,
yes,
I guess now.
Yes, that's right. Well, that, as you well know, of course, was the home of the Lone Ranger.
And yes, and Sergeant Preston.
That's right, the Challenger of the Yukon.
Who was Sergeant Preston? I don't remember.
Well, Sergeant Preston originally was Paul Sutton. And then later, when the Lone Ranger went off the air, Brace Beamer, who played the part of the Lone Ranger, stepped in and...
Wow. Brace Beamer, I think, is dead now, isn't he?
Yes, he passed away a little over a year ago.
That's amazing. That had enormous popularity in the Midwest, because I remember the Lone Ranger was on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. Was it Tuesday or Thursday that the Green Hornet
the
was
Green
on?
Heart, the Green Hornet was on both days, Tuesday and Thursday, so we had a strip at the same time, 7:30.
That was a half hour.
That's right.
That. Gee, the opening, I have a copy of the opening, but it was put out by two whole programs, as a matter of fact, put out by Special Recordings, which is a firm in Detroit, Michigan. I'm not going to do a commercial, but if anyone wants to write me for the address, you can buy these things. They have an album of the Lone Ranger, which is an original, two original Lone Ranger programs, and one of the Green Hornets. Let's play the opening now so people get an idea how it began.
The Green Hornet. He hunts the biggest of all game, public enemies who try to destroy our America. With his faithful valet Cato, Fritz Reed, daring young publisher, matches wits with the underworld, risking his life that criminals and racketeers within the law may feel its weight by the sting of the Green Hornet. Ride with Fritz Reed in the thrilling adventure of A Matter of Evidence.
You were doing takes when that was on. Now, what were you thinking?
Brings back a few memories, Richard.
It has to. That ending, I think, is a little bit different than the one I remember. I'm sorry, I don't mean the ending. I mean the introduction. He
plays
the biggest of all games.
That's right.
Public enemies that even the G-men cannot trace.
That's right.
The one I recall.
Yeah, there was a story, which I think you mentioned when we were discussing this before, that the FBI objected to this strenuously because there were a few crooks around, apparently, that the G-men couldn't reach. But that really was not the intent of the statement. You see, George W. Trendle, who owned the program, the same gentleman, of course, who had the Lone Ranger for so many years, was an attorney. And he got some of these cases from his original file. And when he said the G-men cannot reach, he meant that they were operating inside the law. So legally, they had every right to operate. And as such, of course, the G-men could not touch them. It didn't have anything to do with their inefficiency. It meant that because of certain legal tricks, they could not arrest these people.
That's right. It was G-men could not reach, not
right.
G-men could not trace.
Exactly right. So I rather doubt the authenticity of the story about J. Edgar Hoover or the FBI objecting to this. It's possible. Of course, legends arise as time goes on about so many things.
That came from, the Great Radio Heroes, the Jim Harmon book, I think is where I got that story, that it was a complaint by the FBI that changed it.
Could be. I read some things in the book, and it's a fascinating book. Of course, he has three chapters on WXYZ and the three programs that came out of there at the time.
I didn't realize it was for a while a local program. How long was it just in Michigan?
I don't remember, Richard. It started out that way, only on the Michigan Radio Network. They had a 7 or 8 station network. And then, as I remember, it did go to Toledo and then eventually, of course, went coast to coast.
Because it really was required listening for, I think, any kid who grew up in that era, in that area. Also, the other ones like Tom Mix and his Ralston Straight Shooters or Captain Midnight or Jack Armstrong. You'd listen to either one or the other. I mean, my friend Eugene, who lived next door to me, or my cousin Bob, they would listen to one, and I would listen to the other, and we'd discuss it the next day. But in the evening, you would listen to the Green Hornet. There was just nothing else. Like the Lone Ranger.
Yeah, that's true. And of course, they were stripped 5 days a week right across the point. And we've got in the WXYZ habit pattern there eventually.
I never watched the TV version. I guess it isn't on anymore, is it?
No,
Green
it's
Hornet.
Not.
Yeah, do they have
Wait a minute,
Black
I think
Beauty
they are
on?
Doing some repeats on it now somewhere. But no, they're not making any more.
Did they have a Black Beauty?
Oh, by all means, a beautiful car.
You know, I always thought the Black Beauty was the Tucker. Remember the
Oh, yes, with the Cyclops eye in the front. Mm-hmm.
When that first came out, I thought they copied it, the Green Hornet.
Well, we made a picture of it. We did a serial of it in Hollywood. I say we, I didn't. Well, I did in a sense. I did the voice over on the film. Actually, Gordon Jones, who is, pick a name, Jack Jones' uncle, or Alan Jones' brother, was the Green Hornet in the first serial film made of it by Universal in Hollywood. And they had the thing all shot and in the can, and he was excellent as Britt Reed, but he didn't seem to have enough toughness or guts, if I may use that word, in his voice as the Green Hornet. So they asked me to fly out there. This was in 1938. I remember taking a DC-3 and hopping like a barnstormer across the country in this thing to go to Hollywood and do the voice on it. And we did it on 40-foot loops. I never saw the picture. All I had was the soundtrack to listen to with a headset on.
Oh, I think I saw all 13 chapters at the Cinderella Theater on Kirchville Avenue. Sure.
But I did the voice on the thing then.
What were you telling me about the people who own special recordings, the ones that...
Oh, yeah, that's owned by the Two Front Feet of Silver, the Lone Ranger's famous voice. The Two Front Feet being two gentlemen named Ernest Winstanley and Fred Flowerday, who have special recordings now. And that is their company.
Funny, you know, that a lot of programs, not a lot, but a number of them, came from Detroit, Chicago, and Cleveland. I guess none do now. Don McNeil's Breakfast Club still comes from Chicago. I can't think of any other national program that comes from the Midwest. Can you?
I'm thinking, and I honestly can't...
Either TV or radio.
I can't think. Of course, there is so little network radio now, Richard. I can't think of a one, frankly.
But there's no TV show either that I know. They used to do the... what's the show that's now out of Philadelphia that came from Cleveland? Mike Douglas.
That's right.
He came from, I think, Cleveland. But that's a syndicated show. There's nothing coast to coast.
I don't think there is at all.
And there were a number of them that came a lot from Chicago.
Yes, more
and,
of course.
And I think The Battle of the Sexes, the one that Julia Sanderson used to do with Frank Crummett, I think was from...
Well, that used to be kind of an actor's progression. If you wanted to work as an actor in network radio... You would start out doing a local work somewhere, and then you never came directly to New York. You went probably first to Detroit, if you could, and played bit parts because, of course, Detroit had its own stock company, and this was pretty hard to crack.
It seems amazing going back, you know, to Detroit now, because I was there about a year ago, because there's nothing that would suggest there was anything like that ever went on.
Of course not.
It's all gone. Funny, just 30 years it's over with. I love some of the things that they had on that Green Hornet. I didn't listen to this recording, which you can buy, by the way. If anyone wants it, they just write into me, and I'll give them the address of either the Green Hornet or for the Lone Ranger. They're both available. But the gas gun. See, I just can't remember that. They always said, take it, rat.
<They're> going, That's right.
Was that that stuff they sell in pencils now that girls squirt in the masher's face?
Oh, I don't know. I think this was probably just as efficient. But
he never killed anyone. He left people out cold for the police.
That's true. You know, this happened to me twice. It's very strange because in the Green Hornet, I had a gas gun which simply immobilized people until you managed to either tie them up or make an escape. And later on, when I got into television, they did Captain Video. They gave me the same sort of a gun. I had something like a stun gun. And again, you simply immobilized people. They never let me kill anybody.
A stun gun? It was called.
Right.
That's right. Flash Gordon had the paralyzing ray.
That's right.
Speaking of Flash Gordon, did you look much at that book before we began? A friend of mine named Woody Gelman sent me a book. He's a big nostalgia nut. And this is an enormous book. I wonder what it measures. It's called Flash Gordon, a classic from the golden age of the comics. It's a beautifully done book in a rather peculiar shape. It's huge, with the old Flash Gordon comic strips in it. It's amazing, all this interest lately in these comic book characters. But this is very nicely done. I guess it's out on in the bookstores now. I don't know who the publisher is. It's by Alex Raymond, And I know Doubleday has it because I saw it in there the other day. Flash Gordon. I guess if you just go in and ask for Flash Gordon, you can pick it up there. But it's amazing, all this interest. Now they put the Batman on television, and they had Green Hornet for a while. It's funny. I wonder why that is. Because we're closer to a space age now. You'd think they'd be less impressed by people who could go from one planet to another.
Well, that's true. But, of course, maybe the answer is that since we are now really doing it in so many areas, it may have more interest because of that, because it used to be pure fantasy. And now a lot of science fiction is more science than fiction.
Yeah, it's funny. I asked when we had the group on from the old Buck Rogers show. We had Buck Rogers and the girl who played his girlfriend and the doctor, you know, always the... Not the mad doctor, the good doctor who was on it. So like Flash Gordon and a Dr. Zarkov. And I said, did you ever think that you'd live to see the day when these things would become within the realm of possibility? And they all said no. They didn't. They thought it would come about, but never within their lifetime.
Within their time at all.
Yeah. It's amazing how things have changed. Tell me, if you would, the story about Cato, how Cato was changed as the political climate in the country changed.
Well, now, there's some argument as to this. Now, in this book to which you just referred, it is indicated that Cato had actually been called a Japanese of Filipino descent as back far back as 1940. Now, that's possible. Now, but I do remember when we were casting for Cato, and we were looking for an authentic Japanese to play the part. It could be that there was some mention later on around 1940 that he was a Filipino somewhere, but he, believe me, when we started with the Japanese, and we did definitely change him to a Filipino as soon as we became involved in this conflict with Japan. But his name was Tokutaro Hayashi, and he owned a sukiyaki restaurant on Grand Boulevard up near the Wilding Picture Studios. You know that area, Richard.
Yeah, I know it very well. Mary's Grand Boulevard around there.
What happened was, in casting it, James Jewell, who was the director of both the Lone Ranger and the Green Hornets at that time, called Wilding Pictures to see through their casting department if a Japanese actor were available. And they had used one, and they found him because the sukiyaki restaurant was next door. And one day, they just happened to wander in and found a Japanese. They needed one in a picture they were making over there, and he was fine. And they were looking for a couple of Chinese actors at the same time. We happened to have a couple of Chinese actors in our file, so it was a very funny story. We said, fine, I'll make a switch. Two type Chinese for a Japanese, and we're both in business. And that's how we got a hold of Cato. He was a wonderful little fellow, and... I remember he invited the cast up to the sukiyaki restaurant one time for a dinner. We were all delighted to go. Reagan, we'd have some wonderful, authentic Japanese dishes and, of course, special Japanese red carpet service. And he went out of his way to get sweet corn steaks, mashed potatoes, and gravy because he thought all of us lovely American people like something with which we were totally familiar. We didn't even see a glass of sake.
I am amazed that they even had a Japanese restaurant in Detroit because they didn't go much for the fur and food in the Midwest, you know.
No,
Katsui is about as far out as they got when I lived there.
Yeah, I was pretty successful with it, as a matter of fact.
Well, there might have been some sophisticates around in that area, but I sure didn't know them when I lived back there. I remembered when I looked at the back of the album, the Green Hornet album, something I'd forgotten, that he was the grandnephew of the Lone Ranger.
Oh, you'd forgotten that? Oh, my, certainly. Dan Reed was the Lone Ranger's nephew and Britt Reed's father.
He had much more to do with girls, though, than the Lone Ranger. The Lone Ranger had no truck at all with pretty girls.
Oh, no. Well, this was in the typical Western fashion. You know, he kissed
Hop,
her on the nose occasionally.
Yeah. Hop along, cast your Jean off.
Oh, no, that you couldn't. Oh, my goodness. No.
But Britt Reed, like Brett Morrison, the Shadow, had a girlfriend.
Well, no, Britt Reed never really had a girlfriend.
Well, she had a crush on him, though.
She had a crush on him.
Yeah,
Miss Case, the secretary, had a definite
crush. Lenore Case.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. That was Jim Jewell's sister, the director's sister, who played the part.
But he was, when he was his real self, he was the handsome playboy.
Yes, he was supposed to be out and around hitting all the night spots. And although there was never, to my memory at least, a scene in a night spot anywhere that indicating that he did any of this.
No,
this
he was
his reputation.
An awful lot from his mansion.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
It's funny how we believe that. Of course, I think radio had a great deal to do with it. You were really able to imagine an escape.
Well, this, as I've said so many times, Richard, radio was such a wonderful medium in that area because, you know, you could do the Fall of Rome on radio. All you needed was
they
a good
did.
Narrator.
They did. What was that wonderful program that CBS had called You Are There?
Yes.
One of the most exciting things I ever
That's
heard.
Right.
And the eruption of Mount Vesuvius. And I remember they had the sound effects of the hot ashes falling on the sound truck.
Yeah, yeah. But can you imagine trying to do that on television? I mean, it wouldn't be at all the way you would imagine it. But you can visualize this thing totally if you hear it. And make up your own idea of what the characters look like. And, of course, your impression of what Britt Reed looked like and somebody else's impression of what he looked like might be two totally different things.
Well, as a matter of fact, he looked just like he does on the drawing on the back of this album.
Do you?
That's exactly what he looked like to me, yeah. And Cato, of course, looked Japanese.
Yeah.
And the detective was talking
Michael
about
Axman.
The Green Hornet.
Yeah.
What was the paper was the Daily Sentinel.
Right.
I must say, I'm not recalling all these things, and I have some notes in front of me. But a lot of them I would remember. The Green Hornet seal, I remember he always left that.
Yeah,
to let the police know that he was the one who did it.
And we stamped it on people's foreheads and arms and everything else. Sometimes they'd simply wake up after having a whiff of Hornet gas and see that the seal of the Green Hornet was stamped on their forehead.
Was the announcer Mike Wallace when you were on the show? I see he did a turn on that.
Yeah, we had a number of announcers. Yeah, Mike did it for quite a while.
I didn't really even realize he went back that far in radio.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah, we had a number of... Mike was there. I think Doug Edwards had just left, though. Doug was there at the same time.
You started to tell me a story the last time you were on this program, off mic, when we were, I think, taking a voice level, and I wish you'd tell it now, about how Mutual was formed.
Yeah. Well, the Lone Ranger actually was responsible for the founding of the Mutual Broadcasting System. The Lone Ranger originally went on. It only went again locally in Detroit, and then later on the Michigan Radio Network. But it was sold then to Silver Cup Bread. And they had breakeries in Chicago, Cincinnati, and in New York. And they wanted coverage of some kind to put the program in all four stations. Of course, in those days, there was no tape, although we were making acetate recordings of the thing. But in order to get the four stations together, they had to have some sort of a cue indicating that the program was off the air. That same reason, of course, that NBC used the chimes and the other networks had some sort of an identifying cue. So since this was not a network per se, that is an incorporated situation, they did need some sort of a sign to indicate that the program was over, and since it was done for their mutual benefit, they simply decided to call it the Mutual Broadcasting System, and that's where the whole thing started. Which included at that time WGN in Chicago, WLW in Cincinnati, and WOR in New York. Or actually in Newark at that time, which was the Bamberger station.
That's funny because I always remember, again, the Lone Rangers being WXYZ, which was the Blue Network and ABC.
That's right. But it originally was on the Mutual Broadcasting System. And, of course, we did repeat the show to the West Coast every night as well. And this turned out to be quite a problem because we also made an acetate recording of it in Chicago, which RCA did for us, on a feed to the West Coast. And where we might take a break in the script for a middle break while we were doing it ourselves, we could take it at any time we wished. That is, any time within a limit, somewhere in the middle of the program. But since you were limited to somewhere near 14 to 15 minutes on an acetate disc, we had to sometimes rewrite the middle of the program in order to find a break at the right time so we could get it the whole half hour on two acetate discs.
Acetate, describe to me how they work.
Well, that's simply an aluminum disc with an acetate coating on it. And from this, of course, you can go ahead, and then you can make a master or a mother and a wax impression like you would, but the actual recording was done on an acetate disc.
Was it like wax? Would you call it a wax disc? Because Jim Amici was telling me, as you probably know, he was Jack Armstrong for a number of years. He told me that the earliest recordings he remembers were on wax, and if you made any mistake at all, you began again, and they would put a large razor, which would shave, you know, so much of the top of the disc off. Is this a different recording?
This will be a little different. You can do that with a wax. I mean, you might be able to do it with acetate. I'm really not that familiar.
This was very early. I think about 32, 33, he's talking about, when he did the Jack Armstrong out of Chicago. I think is where that began.
That could have been on wax, which would be a different process then.
You're not in radio or TV anymore. Why don't you tell them what you're doing in case they didn't hear Captain Video?
Well, I have a very interesting job now, Richard. I'm working with Olsen Temporary Services. And as a matter of fact, I meet a tremendous number of actors and old friends of mine in New York who, either between shows or because they need to pick up some extra money here and there, come into Olsen and take part-time temporary assignments, either in office work or clerical work. And a lot of the gals with whom I used to work are with our sales boosters division, which is our marketing services. And we send them out to trade shows and conventions where they act as demonstrators and hostesses. But a large part of my work is done in recruiting, trying to interest a housewife who's had some previous office experience to pick up her typing and shorthand and stenographic abilities again and come back and work a day or two on a temporary assignment. And it's amazing the number of people who do this. About 80% of the people that we have that we send out are housewives. And the average age is around 38 years because their families by this time are pretty much out of the way. But they do it not primarily for the money, Richard, which I think is an interesting thing. They get sort of housebound, you know, and once they get out and get the hair curlers out of their hair and the house coat off in the morning, and they discover they're really a different person again. And they take on a new personality or find one they had before. It's an interesting thing I'm doing, and I'm quite entranced by the whole thing.
Well, I think it's good for anybody to keep busy. It's probably very healthy.
Gives me a chance, too, to be a little ham, you see, because I go out and talk to these women's clubs. So whatever acting I would like to do, I get a chance to make a speech here and there. So that helps a little bit.
Al Hodge and I met, when was it, about two and a half months ago. One Friday afternoon, we went up to the after offices and tell them some of the people we met. We took a photograph to begin with for the back jacket of my next book, whatever became of Volume 2. But tell the people who...
Oh, I'm trying to remember now. We had Cliff Carpenter there, I think, didn't we?
No, he wasn't. I remember the characters' names. You can...
Oh, well,
Bob Perkins.
I remember the people.
Virginia Payne.
Virginia Payne.
And Pepper Young.
Yeah, well, that was Cliff. And then we had Jackson Beck.
Jackson Beck and John... Isn't that awful? He played Ethelbert. John Gibson.
Ann Elsner.
Casey, Crown photographer.
That's
Stas Cotsworth. Ann Elsner, who was Stella Dallas.
Right.
The only ones I think we missed were Helen Trent, who couldn't make it that day.
I think her little girl was sick.
And our gal Sunday, who had some other appointment. But there were 13 of them there, which is, I thought, a pretty good turnout.
It wasn't a bad turnout at all. I had more fun than the circus with people with whom I used to work and hadn't seen for years.
How long has it been since you've seen someone?
Oh, golly, I don't know. Because, you see, after I finished working the Green Hornet, I spent a great many years in New York doing soap operas and practically everything that... Well, not only soap operas, but anything on radio that came out of New York, I think I was on at one time or another. So a lot of these people were so familiar to me. And, oh, golly, I don't think I'd seen Ann Elsner in... 10 or 15 years, anyway.
She's an amazing woman. You know, I always think she really halfway believes that she's Stella Dallas. I think a number of people tell me that. She goes into that character so easily in her restaurant. She has a restaurant in Lambertville, New Jersey.
Have you been over there? I know she has.
Oh, yes. It's
have
a
you?
Delightful restaurant with very good food. It's right on a river, on the Delaware. Faces, and has a big glassed-in porch, and you can look at the river. And there's an aviary inside of the restaurant, so you can have your table around the aviary. It's all glass, and look at some very beautiful exotic birds. But people come in there, I'm sure, every day. Because it says Stella Dallas's River's Edge Restaurant.
Uh-huh.
And the signs up and down the highway, you couldn't possibly miss it. You are coming close to Stella Dallas's River's Edge
does
Restaurant.
Does she use Stella Dallas in her...
Oh, yes, she
does. I didn't know that.
She told me that she got... I said, how can you do that? Because Stella Dallas is a name. It's copyrighted. She said she knew the author, whose name I can't remember. It was a woman. And the woman gave her permission. So that's what it's called, Stella Dallas. And people come in, you know, from all over the country because it's near Bucks County. It's right on the line from Bucks County. They say, gee, I remember you and your lolly baby. She goes right into that character.
I have to tell you a funny story. You just mentioned Helen Trent, which brought this to my mind. But Julie Stevens played Helen Trent.
One of the prettiest ladies I know.
Yeah, she's a doll.
Isn't she?
And David Gothard was her boyfriend on this thing all the time.
Yeah. Gil Whitney,
that's right. I remember the real people. You remember the name. But they played this part. Lived at the Waldorf. So Frank and Ann Hummer decided they would like to get a good spread of it coming out of the Waldorf and getting into a Cadillac, a carry, of course, but it looked like it was his with a chauffeur and everything. Believe me, people in soap operas didn't make this kind of money. But they got a beautiful picture, and it ran in one of the radio magazines, full-color page. But in the cut line underneath the picture, they lost a stick of type somewhere. And when it came out in all its glory, it said, and if I can remember this correctly, David Gothard, conceived by Frank and Ann Hummert. And they left out the line about star of Helen Trent. And this was so funny. And we never, of course, left
the
poor guy
with
a doubt. Very funny. Very funny indeed.
Aunt Hubbard is still living here in New York, you know. I'd love to get her to do one of these programs.
I think she'd be delighted to. She's a charming person.
Because she certainly must have stories.
Oh.
It's amazing what they produce.
I think they had 20...
30-some shows.
I was going to say 24, going on 24 per week.
Yeah. And many of them were dailies, right?
Well, I think they had three nighttime shows, and I believe the rest were strip shows.
Well, I think Mr. Keene was a Hubbard show.
Mystery Theater. Mr. Chameleon.
Mr. Chameleon was. There was one other that I'm trying to think of that was a Hubbard show. It might have been Famous Jury Trials. Or Missing Heirs. I always listen to Missing Heirs. Well, they used to find people, you know. I always thought that they would... Someone in Poland would have left me.
I love that.
Like, 2 million zloty.
The theme music of Mr. Keene. Well, that one incidentally went into a half-hour show, I believe, nighttime.
Yeah,
Keene's
I always remember
Lost Persons. Right. And their theme song always absolutely killed me.
They had two theme songs, though. Now, which
they
one do you remember?
Someday I'll Find You.
Someday I'll Find You. But the other one was I'm Always Chasing Rainbows.
Oh, that one I
don't even know. Now, that's what I'd love to ask her. Why they changed that? Because they were both funny.
Very funny.
I think it ended with you. That was the last... One thing in the last years, it was Someday I'll Find You, the Noel Coward tune. But I remember I'm Always Chasing Rainbows. And I remember the switch. It must have come sometime in the 40s because it was a good show. He's dead, the fellow who played Mr. Keene.
Yes.
I think the fellow who played Pat Patton, it wasn't Pat Patton, but it was a name like that. The detective who helped him with the Irish brogue. He's still around someplace.
Well, Carl Swenson did Mr. Chameleon, of course.
Yeah.
You see Carl quite often on television.
Yeah, I think he works mostly from the coast.
He does, totally from the coast now.
None of them have moved out there. One of the Mr. and Mrs. North people did. I can't think of which one, because I tried to put together a Mr. and Mrs. North show and a Thin Man show. I think one of them are out there, too. You're like all those people I meet. You know, they really loved radio.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
I had such a kick out of reading this book that you're referring to.
The Great Radio Hero.
Yes.
Well, another one that's very good is I'm always referring to it. I've got it here. Radio's Golden Age, which is by two friends of mine, Frank Buxton and Bill Owen. You're
on
that, of course, quite a bit, too.
Mm-hmm. There are a couple of things I noticed in this book that you mentioned. A couple of statements with which I take some exception.
Oh, well, mention them.
All right. I think it was mentioned that the Green Hornet was named because Green Hornets allegedly had the angriest dispositions and were most liable to stink.
It does say that.
So the truth of the matter is that it was originally called the Hornet, and we discovered we could not copyright the name without an adjective in front of it. And that was the reason we had to pick one. So it could have been blue, purple, or anything. Of course, a pink hornet wouldn't fit very well. They suddenly decided upon the word green. To my knowledge, there isn't any such thing as a green hornet.
I'm not that familiar with hornets, so I don't know. It was never on the air by the name of the Hornet.
No,
was it?
No.
Yeah, it was a working title.
That's right.
What were some of the other things?
Well, I think you also mentioned that an actor named Gil Shea had played the part of Michael Axford, when actually it was played by a real wonderful little character actor named Jim Irwin. And he was an old pal of Victor Herbert's. That's how far back he went. He used to go up to Saratoga and hang around with Victor, and the stories he told were delightful. But Jim was the original Michael Axford in this thing. And we did talk about Cato. And in the book, they mentioned the part was played by Raleigh Parker. Well, that was much later on because my little Japanese friend, Tokutaro Hayashi, who had the Sukiyaki restaurant, of course, was the one who played the original Kato. So he was, no matter what the books say, he was cast as a Japanese.
That's still there.
You were there.
Good. Well, we've had Al Hodge today rebutting some of the statements made in the Great Radio Heroes, and he should know whereof he speaks because he was the original Green Hornet, along with playing a lot of other soap operas during the 30s and 40s, and then he was Captain Video, as anyone knows who listened to this program a few months ago. Thanks very much for being here, Al Hodge.
It's my pleasure, Richard. Always is.
Remembering radio. And I always look forward to programs on radio.
I also wanted to say that I'm looking anxiously to see your new book, which is coming out in June, I believe.
Yeah,
a lot of these people mentioned
it. Yeah, in June, with your picture on the back cover. Thank you very much. My guest today was Al Hodge, the Green Hornet. And until next week at the same time, this is Richard Pancroft. Thank you for listening. Good night.